southwards, dry and bright with some sunshine. But here, clouding over, I think, on Sunday with some showery outbreaks of rain, particularly in the southeast. Further north, though, it should be much better on Sunday, Jim.
All right, Darren, thank you very much. Have a good night. It's here on Radio 4. It's time for Book of the Week. And matters of political reform looms large during the reign of William IV. Passage of the bill through Parliament is stalled, which causes uproar in parts of Britain. That's in Perilous Question by Antonia Fraser.
The rejoicing in the country for William IV's coronation on the 8th of September 1831 was almost universal, and cries of God save the King seemed endless. There was one significant new prayer. The Lord give you a faithful Senate, wise councillors and magistrates, loyal nobility, dutiful gentry. One can easily believe that this prayer found a heartfelt echo in the royal breast. It remained to be seen in the coming weeks whether that part of the Senate, known as the House of Lords, was indeed so faithful. The great debate started in the House of Lords on the 3rd of October. The Duke of Sussex presented a petition from merchants, bankers and traders of Bristol, nearly 26,000 names altogether. The petitions rolled on. There were, for example, over 33,000 signatures from Manchester. Lord Grey now rose to his feet and moved the second reading of the Reform Bill in the House of Lords. He was, however, a man very recently pierced by personal tragedy. On the 24th of September, Durham's son, Charles Lambton, gave up his struggle to survive tuberculosis and died. The pathetic funeral cortege of a 13-year-old boy was actually passing north as Grey, the devastated grandfather, rose to speak. "In the course of a long political life," he began, a phrase he was entitled to use, given that he had entered Parliament 45 years earlier. And then he had to sit down, labouring to master strong emotion. Recovering, Grey declared boldly that if reform had sometimes appeared to slumber, it had never slept. There were cheers and counter-cheers. A particularly serious passage in Grey's speech was an address to the bishops, who were by tradition members of the House of Lords. Contemporary attacks on the bishops ranged from the designation of them as black locusts to Francis Place's more florid malediction: luxurious, rich, overbearing and benumbing. Church tithes caused much unpopularity for obvious reasons at times of economic distress. Nor was it forgotten that a clergyman had actually read the Riot Act at Peterloo. Lord Grey implored the prelates to consider what would happen to their standing in the country if the bill was rejected by their votes in the House of Lords. Were they not the ministers of peace? Then Grey ended by announcing that he was not prepared to compromise. It was the bill and the whole bill. "My lords, I have now done." In Birmingham, on the same day, the Union held a meeting on Newell Hill. In his speech, Thomas Attwood asked the whole assembly, having bowed their heads, to look up to the heavens, where the just God ruled both heaven and earth, and cry, "God bless the King." Everyone present duly shouted out in acclamation of their sovereign. The next day, the Birmingham Political Union's petition to the House of Lords was presented by the Lord Chancellor, Lord Brougham, along with 79 others. There was no doubt that Brougham's peroration on the final day of debate eclipsed all other speeches. It did so partly due to his amazing eloquence, but partly because of the eccentricity of his behaviour. His gestures, his craggy figure with the famous much-caricatured bottle nose, and perhaps the allusion to a bottle was justified, were in themselves almost as persuasive as his words. Brougham struck a majestic note of warning. Raise not the spirit of a peace-loving but determined people. Alienate not the affections of a great empire from your body. I beseech you, I solemnly adjure you, yes, even on bended knees, my lords. Here, according to the times, Braun bent his knee upon the woolsack. I implore you not to reject this bill. There followed a prolonged and heartfelt bout of Whig cheering. Afterwards, there was some controversy about that modest genuflection in the direction of the woolsack. Was it in fact an involuntary fall, not a genuflection at all? Lord Lyndhurst had this to say. He continued some time as if in prayer, but his friends, alarmed for him, lest he should be suffering from the effects of the mulled port he had demonstrably been imbibing, picked him up and replaced him safely on the woolsack. Edward Littleton, MP, an eyewitness who described the speech as one of the most splendid conceivable, and served with argument and admonition to a degree that made one tremble, did not mention the fall. But he did record that in the course of a speech which was over 3 hours long, Braun drank 3 immense soda water bottles full of hot negus. At 6:30 in the morning, the government were defeated by a majority of 41 against the bill. It was noteworthy that 21 bishops out of 23 voted against it. Perhaps it was the exhaustion of the night, the lateness of the hour. Sir Denis Le Marchant reflected that there was no sense within the House that a measure was being decided which might cause the land to be deluged in blood. Very different was the reaction of those, the thousands, the hundreds of thousands, dedicated to the cause, who were outside. Expressions of disappointment and indignation arose loudly. There was a feeling of thunder in the air. In Paris, Harriet Granville, wife of the British ambassador, was quite clear about what the House of Lords had done. "They have made their own 25th of July," she wrote, referring to the French Revolution, and the news made her shudder. On the 8th of October, 1831, the frightful majority of 41 against reform in the Lords was published in the Sun newspaper, fringed in black. Unsurprisingly, there were crowds of angry hooters outside the House of Lords itself. Prominent ultra-Tories like Lord Dudley found members of the mob trying to grab the reins of his horse until the spirited steed gave a great leap and dispersed them. The hated Duke of Cumberland was pelted with mud. "What have the Lords done?" asked the Times in a leader on the 10th of October, before answering its own question. "They have done what they can never undo. The nation willed it. The Lords forbade it. Will the nation give way? Or will the Lords?" On Wednesday, the 12th of October, a huge march took place in London, intending to present a petition to William IV at St. James's Palace. Here were respectable people, housekeepers, shopkeepers, and superior artisans. Not only petitions, but flowers and cockades were fragrantly showered on the marchers as they passed. The various deputies were persuaded to wait prudently in nearby St. James Square, while Joseph Hume and another MP presented their petitions. Later, past 10 o'clock at night, Francis Place led a self-styled delegation of members of London parishes to No. 10 Downing Street. There was no appointment, but Grey agreed to see them. The demand of the delegates was simple. Grey should pass the bill in 7 days by the expedient of peer creation. Grey's lofty manner, his idealistic purpose, evidently did not help him to communicate with clever, determined men from a different class such as Place. He described the occasion in a letter to Joseph Parkes. Grey had uttered hard-line sentiments about popular uprisings. If the people rioted, they would be bayoneted, shot, and hanged. Apparently, Grey did not intend to propose the creation of peers. "What say you now to your motto, peers or revolution?" inquired Place of Parks. Despite the misunderstanding, Francis Place was deeply impressed by one thing: Grey's integrity. He was the most open and manly of prime ministers, and thus Place had at least confidence in Grey's intention to do good, even if he questioned his judgment. After this meeting, Francis Place went on to enjoy the hospitality of the philosopher radical George Grote and his famously intellectual wife Harriet at their salon in Threadneedle Street in the city. Both were, or would be, writers. They were in their late 30s and childless. Mischievous Sidney Smith summed up the Grotes thus: "I like him, he's so ladylike, and I like her, she's such a perfect gentleman." On this occasion, as Francis Place fulminated about Grey's vacillation, as he saw it, the Grotes and their circle of intellectual reformers rejoiced in the developments which they saw in a far more favourable light. Meanwhile, the West Country of England seethed. Mary Frampton, sister of James Frampton, Justice of the Peace and Colonel of the Dorset Yeomanry, wrote a vivid account of it all in her diary. "At the town of Sherborne, matters began on the 19th of October with cries of reform from the rough types gathered for the traditional October Pack Monday fair. Then a considerable mob broke every pane of glass they could find at Sherborne Castle, home of Lord Digby, and even tried to force the gates. Tranquillity was eventually restored by yeomanry troops, although the vicarage of the Reverend Mr. Parsons was much damaged. Here, according to the Sherborne Journal, the doors were forced, the window frames torn out, the furniture broken up, hogsheads of beer staved, spirits consumed and wasted, and in fact the most wanton acts of spoliation resorted to." The Reverend Parsons, an acting magistrate, fared even worse than his house. He was knocked down by the mob, shamefully ill-treated, and only saved by being taken to a neighbour's, where he lay senseless for some hours. There were riots in Derby on Sunday the 9th of October, and an assault on the jail to rescue prisoners taken the night before, which failed. One bystander was killed. The next day, the mayor refused permission for a public meeting, but set up stalls so the public might organise their petitions to Parliament. Unfortunately, matters had gone too far for such peaceful methods. The mob destroyed the stalls, and the Riot Act was read. In the ensuing fracas, three more innocent men were killed. In Nottingham, on the 10th of October, a mob assaulted another castle. This time they were successful in getting inside and burning it down. This was a gleeful development, given that the proprietor was the ultra-Tory and enemy of reform, the Duke of Newcastle. The Duke himself was not actually there. He admitted that he had to give the manufacturing districts a wide berth. "I should either be murdered or raise a riot by appearing." Whatever the Lords had intended to do, their rejection of the bill had brought about a crisis, which not only scaremongers and the professionally pessimistic saw as leading rapidly towards revolution.
Adrian Scarborough was reading from Perilous Question by Antonia Fraser. The producer was Duncan Minchell. BBC Radio 4. Now, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 today, Friday the 17th of May. There are warnings of gales in South Utsira, Forties, Dogger, Fisher, German Bight, Trafalgar, Fitzroy and Sole. The general synopsis at 1800, low Fitzroy 997, expected southwest France 998 by 1800 Friday. The area forecast for the next 24 hours, Viking North Utsira, northerly veering northeasterly 3 or 4, increasing 5 to 7 for a time, rain or showers, moderate or poor. South Utsira, northerly veering easterly 5 or 6, increasing 7 or gale 8 for a time in south, rain or showers, moderate or poor. Forties, north or northeast 4 or 5, increasing 6 to gale 8 for a